A moral code during wartime, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A few members of the U.S. military have been convicted of war crimes committed in Iraq and Afghanistan. Some of those crimes are shocking.
There may be situations that aren't clear-cut, but shooting at an Iraqi civilian girl walking down the street is not that.
Now President Trump is reportedly considering pardons in some cases. We hear about the philosophical and practical issues raised by pardoning a war criminal. And later, a scientist pulls off a major first in Antarctic exploration.
I just wish that everyone gets to feel this feeling once in a lifetime.
We dive down into icy water to study the underbelly of a glacier. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Thanks for making it here today. President Trump is getting mixed reviews for something he's reportedly thinking of doing, that is, to pardon several members of the U.S. military who've been accused or convicted of war crimes. The president is said to have asked that paperwork be prepared for that. For some, Trump is absolutely right to consider such pardons, but others see potential problems, like this former military attorney who says issuing pardons to convicted war criminals would risk undermining the rules of our military needs to stay disciplined and effective.
But if those rules are then suddenly undermined because the message is sent that, hey, these rules don't matter, if you're prosecuted, don't worry, I'll take care of it, what happens to good order and discipline? What happens to the effectiveness of our troops? I mean, it's a betrayal.
More from her in just a moment. We also asked military veterans in our audience for their reaction to this story, and we got a lot of responses. Here's a couple of them.
My name is Scott Walker, and I live in Swansboro, North Carolina. I was deployed during Desert Storm. In the late 90s, I was a U.S. Marine mortarman, an 0341. When I first saw that the president was talking about pardoning some guys who had done some war crimes, my thoughts were, what were the crimes? And I just hoped that if the president was going to pardon crimes, it would be something that might have happened as a result of a fog of war, not some premeditated sitting in a room roughing someone up. You know, sometimes when a guy's out on the line and he's holding the position and things happen, you get scared, you want to go home to your family, you're worried about what's going on, where you're at, and sometimes the political climate doesn't jive with your combat situation. You wind up getting in more trouble than you realize you were going to, and you think you're just trying to defend your position. I think our troops need a little bit of protection and latitude to make decisions that are hard, just for the mere fact that we've put them where they're at. The president says, I need you to go do this and that. And when he gets there, we need the president to be behind us, that we did it the best we could. And maybe because we were 18 or maybe because we were scared, we didn't make the greatest decision in the world.
I'm Margaret Seymour, originally from Illinois, and now I live in South Carolina. So I was in the Marine Corps active duty for 10 years. I was deployed to Iraq, Afghanistan, and Kuwait. I was never in combat, but it's honestly, I think to be in combat is hard. It's hard to be a moral person. It's hard to, you know, maintain your sanity, to maintain the sanity and mental health of the people you're in charge of. And so when people do that dishonorably and get a pass, it's a slap in the face to people who didn't commit war crimes. If it was another president, I might trust him to look at the cases and look at the nuance, but I don't. I see it as a Twitter thing. It's like, oh, there's a war hero and everyone's a war hero. And it's not true. You know, some of us are just normal people who aren't war heroes. And then some of us are dangerous people. And I think this hero worship of the military, it leads to stuff like this. It leads to a pass for military members that's dangerous for everyone, military members included.
Just two of the responses to our call out on pardons for war crimes. Thanks to everyone in our vet community who responded to our call for comments. You could read more of what these vets had to say at theworld.org. Rachel Van Landingham is also a veteran. She served as a judge advocate while on active duty in the Air Force. These days, she teaches at Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles. Van Landingham says pardons threaten to undermine the military justice system. And just a word of caution, her descriptions of some of the cases in question are vivid.
there's a very, very heavy burden at a criminal trial called beyond a reasonable doubt. The government has to convince fellow military members that their colleague, beyond a reasonable doubt, did not have legal justification for a killing in these cases. And again, the law of war, the U.S. laws allow for a lot of killing in war, but it doesn't allow for everything. It doesn't allow intentional killing of civilians who are doing nothing. It doesn't allow shooting a naked, defenseless, subdued detainee. It does not allow knifing and stabbing an unconscious, bleeding out Iraqi teenager, regardless of whether he was ISIS or not. That's not how Americans fight. And when these laws are not obeyed, and when their transgressions, which there will always be transgressions, but when their violations are not held accountable, look at My Lai, look at our military in Vietnam. It was so corrosive, right? And so the military, after My Lai, after experiences in Vietnam, instituted what's called the Department of Defense Law of War Program. And one of those strong components of the Law of War Program is a legal obligation to report all credible allegations of war crimes. And there's a legal obligation of commanders to investigate and take appropriate action. That's what the military is doing here. And by undermining that, President Trump threatens the health and the efficiency of the overall military.
Is it hard to distinguish between acts committed in the fog of war and just violent acts that happened during war?
Military members are trained from day one, and in particular, those who are given the rather awesome responsibility to wield deadly force. They're given very, very, very clear rules on how to engage in these situations. And so when they violate and step outside of those rules, if it's fuzzy, if there's any doubt, they're not going to get convicted. It's actually pretty darn rare for any kind of charges regarding an unlawful killing in a combat zone to come up, right? We don't hear these very often because, A, they don't happen very often. Most military members in uniform do the right thing, even in tough situations. It's also hard to hear them because if other folks don't have the moral courage, service members who see this kind of thing happening don't have the moral courage to come forward, we'll never know about it, right? And that's like with the case of Chief Gallagher, who's currently being court-martialed for a murder of a detainee, as well as attempted murder of an Iraqi civilian elderly man and a young Iraqi girl, as well as obstruction of justice. It was his fellow SEALs, right? And the SEALs are some of the most secretive and hardened, battle-hardened warriors that we have, and they've earned that reputation for a good reason. But they're secretive, and they take care of each other. To break that culture of what some would call impunity for committing crimes and step forward, that means even his fellow SEALs said, hey, you've crossed the line. We know you crossed the line, right? And these are the cases that are being brought forward.
There's also the argument put forward by some people who say these soldiers acted in often chaotic wartime situations, again, the fog of war, and that those actions should not be second-guessed by people in Washington who lack combat experience. Don't you feel there's some merit in that argument?
No, I think that's a morally bankrupt argument. It shows a fundamental misunderstanding of what the law of war and what obedience to orders and what the military ethos stands for. These individuals aren't just charged with killing someone on the battlefield. That killing is unlawful because they didn't obey the orders and the rules set down to them by commanders for when to kill and how to kill. There isn't much fog of war of someone being stabbed to death when they're already unconscious.
Rachel Van Landingham is a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force. She now teaches at Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Marco. Have a great day.
One more note on the possibility of presidential pardons for convicted war criminals. We asked Kabul resident Sami Mahdi to weigh in. He's a lecturer at Kabul University. He points out that U.S. troops are still in Afghanistan training local forces, and he thinks that the pardons could harm the already strained relationship between the U.S. and Afghanistan.
If the general public see that there is a justice system which will follow the cases, then that will be a source of relief. But when there is no such kind of justice, then it's going to damage the relationship.
Afghanistan is by far America's longest war, 18 years. That's how long U.S. troops have been fighting the Taliban and other militant groups in the country. But over the past few months, American officials have been sitting down with Taliban representatives to negotiate a possible peace deal. The World's Shirin Jafari has been following the story, and she joins us now. Hey, Shirin.
Hey, Marco. Yeah, I've been following these negotiations in the past months, and just a few days ago, I had a rare chance to connect with the Taliban spokesman. The group tends not to give interviews to Western reporters, but this spokesman agreed to answer some of my questions on WhatsApp.
Yes, so kind of an encouraging moment, it seems, with these negotiations, and you get access to this high-level Taliban spokesman. Who is this person? What do we know about him?
His name is Sohail Shaheen. He's been with the Taliban from its early days. He was educated in Pakistan. He messaged me from Doha, Qatar, where the Taliban has a political office and where the peace talks are taking place. I should say that I was put in touch with Sohail Shaheen through a reliable connection. What I heard from Sohail Shaheen, Marco, was that the Taliban is ready to talk and they want peace in the country and they want the foreign troops to leave so they can be involved in a political process.
So before we get into what Mr. Shaheen told you, give us a quick refresher on the Taliban as a group.
Sure. So the Taliban is an ultra-conservative political and religious group that emerged in Afghanistan in the mid-1990s. After the Soviets withdrew, there were a group of fighters who had resisted the Soviet occupation. The CIA and Pakistan backed them because they wanted to undermine the Soviets. And the Taliban gained momentum, and by the end of the 1990s, their tanks rolled into Kabul, their capital.
Right, the Taliban were in control of Afghanistan, harbored al-Qaeda. Then 9/11 happened. The U.S. and coalition forces chased the Taliban out of power, but not out of the country entirely. Now the U.S. and Taliban representatives have held six rounds of peace talks. What does this imply for the future of the Taliban? Did Sohail Shaheen talk about that?
One of their key demands is that all foreign troops leave the country. They call the foreign troops the occupiers.
We would like our people to regard us as liberator of our country. And after occupation, we want as true servants of the people to work for developing of the country.
He said the Taliban wants to be servants of the people when the U.S. troops leave.
But how is it that they say they want to be servants of the people of Afghanistan, but they're still continuing to kill Afghans? I mean, does Shaheen believe that people will support a Taliban government again?
Marco, even during these peace talks, the Taliban has been carrying out attacks. So one of my questions for Shaheen was, can the Afghans who are not supporters of the Taliban trust this group, especially after foreign troops leave?
There is a strict instruction from our leader to our military commanders to cancel any attack which is feared that it may result in a disproportionate casualties to the civilians.
Marco, I was getting these responses from Sohail Shaheen, the Taliban spokesman, and I was curious how other Afghans would respond to what he says. So I asked Mary Akrami, who's a women's rights activist in Kabul, to listen to Shaheen's comments and tell me what she thinks.
Every day there is an attack in Afghanistan. The Taliban think that by killing more people, they will get more attention and leverage in the peace talks, which is really not the case.
Yeah, that's a significant disagreement. The Taliban say they never attack civilians. Mary Akrami says they do, which makes me wonder how much window dressing these peace talks are. Why is it important that we pay attention to these peace talks, do you think?
Everybody I talk to, Marco, says this is a crucial time in Afghanistan's history. The U.S. has helped bring down a repressive group. It has fought for almost two decades, spent billions of dollars, many lives were lost. The Afghans, too, they have invested a lot of blood and treasure in this war. And so what comes out of these peace talks is extremely important. There's a lot at stake, especially for women who suffered a lot under the Taliban rule.
Obviously, we will be watching these peace talks as they continue.
Yeah, and one more thing, Marco. You can read my full interview with Taliban spokesman Sohail Shaheen at theworld.org.
The World, Shirin Jafari, thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. A fifth child in Border Patrol custody has now died. The 16-year-old Guatemalan migrant was found unresponsive this morning at a facility in Texas. We don't know all the details yet in this case, but health care is increasingly a concern for the high numbers of migrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. The World's Monica Campbell saw up close one effort to tackle these health concerns in Las Cruces, New Mexico, near the border. Volunteers there are trying to provide stopgap health care to migrants, but there's a big question about how long volunteers can handle the demand.
Okay, tell him I'm on my way. Okay.
It's every day, all day, from early morning till late at night. Every day I'm working that network and trying to... Good morning, Celia. Working the network, trying to get people to volunteer. I tell people, I just direct the choir. They do the work.
Can you introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm Frida Adams. I'm a registered nurse, and I am the coordinator for medical volunteers for the shelters in Las Cruces and Doniana County.
Las Cruces, New Mexico. It's not a big city. It's about 100,000 people, and the shelters are for migrants who've often crossed at remote parts of the border. Border patrol stations, especially smaller ones at the border, aren't big enough to hold the number of migrants crossing now, so they're overflowing. In some cases, families are sleeping outside the stations on the ground. In other cases, border agents are loading migrants onto vans with a court date in hand and dropping them off at places like Las Cruces. So that's where the choir Frida Adams mentioned comes in. It's all volunteer nurses and doctors determined to check on migrants who've just been released from federal custody.
They're weary travelers. They've stopped for a little rest and help.
And then it's long bus rides to places like Seattle, Nashville, New York, where relatives are waiting. But it's this brief stopover that worries Adams most, with migrants just arriving to the U.S. after an intense journey.
Without adequate food, without adequate water, without adequate shelter. So by the time they come to the border, they can be extremely dehydrated and exhausted. We make sure they're stable medically. So we're looking for that unstable person medically that we just need to say, you just don't need to get on the next bus. You need to go to the hospital. Pneumonia. We've had a couple of cases of pneumonia. And sometimes they just need an antibiotic. Lives first. Safety first.
She's haunted by what happened in December when two Guatemalan children died in the custody of border officials. The girl was 7 and got a bacterial infection. The boy was 8 and had the flu complicated by sepsis.
That broke a lot of hearts. That's not something that you ever want to see. We're doing everything we can to see that never happens again.
But it's happened again. Last week, a 2-year-old Guatemalan boy died in a Texas hospital after being apprehended at the border. He had pneumonia.
Okay, Daniel, we've got a lot of little ones. Let's see what we got.
In the afternoon, Adams rushes to a county office. Border Patrol just dropped off nearly 100 migrants, all from Central America, a lot of parents with kids. Adams arranges for nurses to be here, volunteers like Kathleen Garza.
I observed each and every one of them looking for any symptoms of lethargy or, you know, poor skin turgor, appearing to be febrile.
What are the ages of the kids, the youngest here?
Here today, the youngest I've seen is 6 months.
The 6-month-old is a boy from Honduras. He's with his mom in a van loaded for the shelter.
You want me to close this for you?
Yes, please.
Okay, we'll be.
At the shelter, I talked to Cindy. She's the young mom with the baby boy, and she's resting on a cot and talks about why she left Honduras.
Por la inseguridad, falta de empleo.
She said she left for reasons of security, for work.
She also says she went full days without much food in Honduras. She and her baby crossed the border through a rocky area and were detained by Border Patrol. Now, she's worried because her baby looks feverish and has diarrhea. He's got a pretty bad diaper rash. A nurse checks the baby's temperature, though, and he's okay and being monitored. The mom's relieved. There's a playground here, blankets, donated clothing. Her son's wearing new sneakers and plaid shorts. She says the night they spent at the Border Patrol station was miserable and chaotic. The cell was cramped and cold, but Cindy says the border agents were polite and she thanked them. After the two children died in December, Trump administration officials pledged to dramatically increase medical staff at the border. I asked David Tarantino about this. He's the senior medical advisor at Customs and Border Protection.
Not all Border Patrol stations are staffed with medical personnel. Now, the priority locations, based on remoteness, based on volume, based on demographics, those have gotten or are getting medical personnel.
But critics say the response isn't tailored for kids and it's not happening fast enough. despite child migration building for years. Congressman Raul Ruiz is a Democrat from California, pushing for better medical checks and medical equipment at Border Patrol stations. He's also an ER doctor and recently saw the Border Patrol station in New Mexico where a Guatemalan girl was held and later died in custody. The station was overwhelmed.
Packed like sardines in a very cold, concrete, windowless room. So packed that you couldn't see the floor. With babies and children sick and coughing. And there were no private areas for any kind of health screening or exam.
Where do you need me, right here or on the other side?
Well, here, if we can get it.
Back at the shelter, nurse Frida Adams checks which volunteers are available for the next day. And then she gets a text. Border Patrol is dropping off more migrants tonight.
35 coming from Border Patrol at 6:30. We will send them out immediately.
She rushes to arrange a pickup because if not, migrants won't have a place to sleep that night.
We're what's keeping them from being dropped at the bus stop, right on the interstate.
But Adams also worries that efforts here might max out.
I don't know how sustainable it will be volunteer-wise. We do have the Medical Reserve Corps, and they've been wonderful. But again, my dream is that we would have teams that would come in and stay a week or two.
Because she doesn't see this situation, the number of people migrating north, families, ending anytime soon.
We're not talking about 2 or 3 months. I'm looking at probably 2 or 3 years.
For The World, Monica Campbell, Las Cruces, New Mexico.
Tomorrow on The World, a health story that starts here in the U.S. and takes us halfway around the globe. It begins with the tens of thousands of computers that Americans throw out each day. Many of those devices are recycled, not here in the U.S., but in scrapyards in Southeast Asia.
The recycling at places like this, it looks more like medieval alchemy. People are hunched over vats of hot metallic sludge, bathing in black smoke.
That's our reporter Patrick Nguyen in Thailand. He takes us to one of those factories to learn about the health effects tomorrow here on The World. Also on the show, what happens to the plastic bottles and packaging we put out on the street to be recycled.
It's cheaper, for example, to send those shipments from the U.S. to countries like Indonesia and Malaysia for so-called recycling rather than send them to a landfill in the U.S.
On the global trail of America's plastic and e-waste, that's on the show tomorrow. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Antarctica, scientists are visualizing the sea floor like never before.
It changes the view of the seafloor massively.
No one has ever seen that kind of data before.
It's like I've been blind all my life and now I've put on glasses.
What that tells us about climate change, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Gathering sound underwater will always yield interesting results, as The World's Carolyn Beeler can attest. That was some of the sound she gathered while on a scientific expedition by ship to Antarctica. One of the goals of this mission, to study a watery cavern, 3/4 of a mile deep in some places, underneath a vast sheet of ice known as Thwaites Glacier. One Swedish scientist was on a mission to see what this underwater cavity could tell us about the future of sea level rise. Carolyn takes it from here.
There's a brand new $3.5 million robotic submarine hanging by a wire off the back of the Nathaniel B. Palmer. And it's swinging what looks like perilously close to the metal gear hoisting it out of the water. Anna Volland's worst fears about her precious orange Hugin submarine are playing on loop in my head.
The biggest fear, I think, is that the Hugin starts to swing wildly and smashes the steering system of the boat, and we all run aground and everyone dies.
I knew she was mostly kidding when she told me that, but still.
So it was like almost just went under the boat.
Bastian Quest, an oceanographer on the ship, turns away. He can't look. He doesn't even want to tell me what he's thinking.
You're not going to be able to put it on the radio.
We can bleep.
It was a f***.
Turns out it looked more dramatic than it really was. The 25-foot torpedo-shaped sub made it back onto the ship just fine after that first test mission. Now, the University of Gothenburg's Anna Volin is one step closer to sending it underneath Thwaites Glacier.
This was the dream. Thwaites and the West Antarctic ice shelf. We made this case when we applied for the money. We said that it's the only way to explore under floating ice shelves.
Those ice shelves are giant overhangs where glaciers extend off of land and into the sea. Scientists believe warm water is reaching underneath Thwaites here and melting it from below. But no one's ever sent anything down there to study it. So scientists don't know for certain that warm water is even there or how far it might reach under the ice. They don't even know how thick the ice is.
We know more about the moon than this particular part of Earth.
And that is a problem, because the future of coastal cities around the world are skating on this glacier's thinning ice. Thwaites is the size of Florida, and it acts like a cork holding back the ice behind it. So if it collapses, it would trigger 11 feet of sea level rise. But predicting when that would happen without direct measurements from the area is nearly impossible. So Anna is itching to see under the ice.
It's not because I want to save the world or anything. I really wonder, what is going on? Is it really like we can read about in the newspapers that we have an Armageddon approaching and we're all going to die in 20 years? But it's curiosity, not fear or anything else.
Anna's been curious about the sea since she was a little girl going sailing with her family.
I remember we would tie up the boat to an island on the west coast of Sweden. We kids would immediately jump off and start to look down into the water and try to feed the crabs. If you sit near the beach and suddenly focus your eyes on what's underneath the water surface, that is very, very fascinating. And I never let go of that fascination.
It's still what drives her today. She's worked for 7 years to get her high-tech submarine and bring it down to Antarctica. She shows it to me up close one day in the shipping container where it's stored.
This is Hugin's little woman cave.
The sub's factory name is Hugin, but Anna tries to remember to use the name she gave her.
Her name is Ran. Ran was the Nordic goddess of the sea. It's a little bit of a poke to the gender imbalance that we do have in physical oceanography.
Anna was just the third woman in Sweden to earn a PhD in oceanography.
We thought this should be her.
That "we" includes Anna's colleague and former PhD student, Alexander Mazur.
It's definitely her. So we are women in science together with Hugin.
In the shipping container, Hugin or Ron's side panels are off, so I can see her inside.
And in here is all the environment sensors, so we have...
These will measure the water's temperature and salinity as Ron glides along the seafloor in routes Anna mapped out. That will reveal how much warm water is getting to Thwaites and how much it's melting the ice.
And this here is the side-scan sonar element.
But before Ron can go under Thwaites, Anna's team spends weeks running test missions in the harsh Antarctic conditions. A combination of weather, timing, and technical issues meant Ron had to skip a key test mission. After that, it didn't look like she'd go under the glacier.
Do you think going underneath the ice shelf with Hugin is at this point unlikely?
Under Thwaites? I think so, yes.
This is a disappointment, but this whole expedition is one long test run. There's another cruise here in 2 years, so Anna will focus now on sending Ron out in front of the glacier. Finally, after a month at sea, we arrive at Thwaites. It's a still, foggy morning, warm enough that Anna's just wearing a sweater outside. And she's giddy, like the rest of the scientists on deck, staring at the glacier for the first time.
We must measure something while we are here.
The sonar.
She's standing with marine geophysicist Ali Graham.
A little bit, but I want to throw something over here. What's the temperature?
You can't just enjoy this, you have to science it.
Yes. No, I can enjoy it too.
Yeah, you can imagine the Hugin kind of...
All stopper.
The
2 days later, Anna finally gets to send Ron out near Thwaites.
Bridge back deck. We're ready to deploy.
She stands on the bridge with Chief Mate Rick Wimkin as he holds the ship steady in the driving snow near the glacier face.
Roger, we're ready for you to deploy.
Crews on the back deck lower the sub into the water. Anna paces along the windows. She eyes a patch of sea ice she wants to avoid.
Louie, start A-framing in, please. Down!
She nervously watches the action 5 decks down on a TV monitor. And it happens. The submarine is finally in the water near Thwaites.
Do you see it? Is it moving? Good. Good girl. Finally.
Ron will dive down now and swim along 2 deep troughs in the seafloor.
The troughs, we think there will be a current here with warm water that runs underneath Thwaites.
And Hugin will be able to measure that, like, right now?
That's right. She's measuring as we speak.
Ron glides along those trenches for the next 13 hours. Anna's pacing starts back again here. The next day when it's time for the sub to come back up.
Yeah, you can help me to look for her.
She's back up on the bridge, scanning the sea with binoculars. A nervous parent waiting for her teenager to come home. She's hunting for a sliver of orange and hoping the sub doesn't resurface under a patch of ice.
Dead ahead, is it?
Yeah, got it.
AUV group, Anna, we have visual contact with Hugin.
When it's safely up, Anna turns toward me slowly with her signature mischievous grin.
We actually took a little tour underneath Thwaites. We didn't want to tell anyone beforehand, but we have done it now.
Really?
Yes, yes.
It went under?
Yeah.
That's huge, Anna.
Yes. Historical.
Can you describe how you feel right now?
No, I can't. I just wish that everyone gets to feel this feeling once in a lifetime.
We're gonna finish up when the Anna rushes down to the back deck where the rest of her team is hosing off Ron and downloading the data she collected. She high-fives Alexandra Mazur, who's thrilled that her mentor has another first to her name.
She was the first woman to send Hugin under the ice shelf.
In fact, any sub under any ice shelf. In a field historically dominated by men, Anna is changing the way we see Antarctic scientists. And she's changing the way we see Antarctica.
It changes the view of the seafloor massively. The visual difference is stunning.
The next day, Ali Graham and Becky Manzoni crowd in front of a computer in the ship's lab. They marvel at Ron's super detailed images of the seafloor. Images that could hold hints about the glacier's future.
It's like I've been blind all my life, and now I've put on glasses, and I can see every individual leaf on the tree, you know? It's beautiful.
Anna would say the same thing about the high-resolution oceanographic data Ron brought back. For the first time, scientists here found and measured the warm water they'd suspected was melting the middle of Thwaites. Once Anna analyzes what Ron brought back from her 2-mile trip under the glacier, she'll be able to estimate how much of that water reached the ice.
No one has ever seen that kind of data before.
And that data will help improve models of sea level rise. Right now, the best estimates show sea levels could increase anywhere between about 0.5 foot to 2.5 feet by 2100. That's a huge range. And that entire gap of uncertainty could be filled just by Thwaites. For Anna, whose curiosity about the ocean has driven her since she was little, eliminating that uncertainty is the ultimate goal.
We have only this one planet that we are living on. I think it's fair to say that we should understand what happens and what goes on and what we can expect in the future.
For The World, Carolyn Beeler.
Check out some amazing sonar images that submarine we just heard about gathered under Thwaites Glacier. They're at theworld.org. Now to another big first in Antarctic research. Back in 1969, when the U.S. Navy finally lifted a ban on women scientists traveling to Antarctica.
There were newspaper articles with headlines like, "Women invade the last bastion of male supremacy on the planet." It was disgusting.
Terry Tickhill-Terrell was one of 4 members of that first all-woman research team from the U.S.
In 1969, I was an undergraduate student, a sophomore, in fact, at Ohio State University. I was reading the school newspaper and saw an article about a graduate student who had gone to Antarctica with a research group and said, "That's a job for me." So I walked into the Institute for Polar Studies at Ohio State, and I said to the secretary there, "Hi, I want a job in Antarctica." And of course, everybody in the room turned around, looked at me, and was astonished. And I think the secretary took pity on me, if nothing else, and she said, "Well, you know, we haven't actually ever sent any women to Antarctica, but Dr. Lois Jones is going to have the first group of women traveling to Antarctica this fall. She has a full team right now, but I can arrange for you to have a little chat with her. Would you like to meet her?" And so I went directly to her office and had a conversation with her. And Lois called me the next day. And I believe what she said to me was, "One of the ladies on the crew has withdrawn. Would you like the job?" And I said, "You bet." I am excited. So the Navy did not necessarily tell all of the sailors who were there that women were coming. So it caused a little bit of a stir when suddenly women showed up. One day, I found a gentleman crying, and I said to him, "Why are you crying?" And he said, "I've been here 14 months, and I must be going crazy because I think you're a woman." And I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I am a woman, and you're not crazy." The purpose of the trip was science. We didn't go there to prove something. We had to prove it while we were there in order to do the science. For example, when we went to snow school to learn how to climb ropes with winter gear on, how to belay people, how to cut ice stairs up the side of a glacier and so forth, the New Zealander who taught snow school said to us, "You are going to flunk out. American women are lounge lizards." We, believe me, did everything within our power to be the absolute four best people in that class. But that's the problem. Everybody underestimated what we could do. They didn't give us a chance to show what we could do until they had to. When we were done, it was very hard to leave. I actually wept the last day when we had to leave the field because it had been such a wonderful experience. I keep saying to people, it was so much fun. When I explain all the ice chopping, lake drilling, rock breaking, and so forth and so on, people don't quite see the fun aspect of it. But it is such a beautiful place, and we were doing such good science, and it taught me what I wanted to be when I grew up.
Terry Tickell Terrell. She was on the first women-only U.S. scientific expedition to Antarctica in 1969. Hey there, World Podcast listener. We're creating a newsletter to help keep all of you up to date with everything we're doing in the world's newsroom. We want you to tell us what you think would be most interesting, most useful for you in a newsletter from the world. So I'm looking at you superfans to help us out and be a part of the world's newsletter focus group. I know you are some of the smartest listeners out there, so your input will be really important to have. Don't worry, it won't take a lot of time. Just send us an email to myworld@theworld.org and write newsletter in the subject line. That's myworld@theworld.org. And thanks. In South Africa, former President Jacob Zuma made a court appearance today. He's facing 16 charges of fraud, racketeering, and money laundering, all relating to an arms deal with a French company in the late 1990s when Zuma was deputy president. He later served as president of South Africa from 2009 until 2018 when he was forced to resign. Zuma was pressured to step down by his own party, the ruling African National Congress, amid persistent allegations of corruption. South African cartoonist Zapiro couldn't be happier that Zuma is back in court. Zapiro has chronicled Zuma's troubled political journey for the past 20 years. Our satire watcher, Carol Hills, has followed Zapiro's cartoon campaign against Zuma for a while now. Carol, is Zapiro just the kind of political cartoonist who takes his poison pen on every politician he sees?
No, not at all. This is very personal for Zapiro. He got his start as a cartoonist in the 1980s as a very active anti-apartheid activist himself. He was detained briefly. He was forced to join the military, refused to carry a gun. So he was really invested in the new South Africa when it finally came. So initially, he was delighted. He was so excited Nelson Mandela was president. But Zapiro wouldn't hesitate to criticize him if he felt like he had to. And Mandela was very respectful of him. When Thabo Mbeki followed Mandela, Zapiro had a tougher time with that, particularly his stand on AIDS. But when Zuma came, he was just devastated. And he had been critical of Zuma way before Zuma became president. But he was just not going to hold back. So there was a lot of personal sense of, is this what I fought for? Is this what everyone fought for? So I talked to Zapiro this morning, you know, the day that Zuma returned to court. And I asked him if he ever felt nervous when he would cartoon Zuma, who eventually was the president of South Africa. You know, he would cartoon him in really tough, graphic ways, whether he ever felt concerned about it.
I've never felt sort of intimidated or scared or anything like that. I mean, look, my first cartoon kind of nailing him for corruption was in 2002. I was so angry at the ANC, this organization that I believed was a powerful, good, principled revolutionary organization, and which turned out to be, I mean, at the moment, it's a shell of its former self. It's corrupt, and there are a few good people there whom one struggles to support. But I was so angry with them that I didn't feel intimidated or whatever. I just felt like I want to nail this guy. And other people should also be nailing him.
At a certain point, you famously installed a showerhead over Zuma in your cartoons of him. Why?
There were charges that people were trying to land on him. In 2003, Zuma was not charged. So the corruption charges were swirling around his head. But in the middle of that, there's this extraneous thing that suddenly lands, a rape trial in 2006. Now, Zuma is a notorious womanizer. He's charged with raping somebody who he knows is HIV positive and happens to be less than half of his age and the daughter of a close friend. But he was, in fact, acquitted. But during the trial, he's asked, you've admitted, you knew she was HIV positive. Now, Zuma had been the head of the National AIDS Program when he was deputy president before this. So he said, weren't you worried about being infected? Did you use protection? No, he didn't. Were you not worried about being infected with HIV? This was at the height of the HIV, the pandemic in South Africa. It was the biggest in the world at the time. And he said, no, he wasn't particularly worried. But then they said, well, what did you do after this supposed consensual sex? I had a shower. Why? To lessen my chance of infection. Okay, the light bulb goes off. Everybody picked up on shower. But I did a cartoon then where I tried to attach the many things that he said trial and during his cross-examination that she was wearing a short skirt. You know, he thought she was kind of asking for it. I mean, he's many things like that. And attached all these things to his body. And the shower is the funniest one. And it said on that first one, for HIV prevention. The next time I did a cartoon, I didn't think the shower fitted. And I did a strong cartoon about him without the shower. And people said, where's the shower?
Is the shower head still over Zuma's head in your contemporary cartoons?
Oh, absolutely. It's very much there. People ask me, don't you miss Zuma? Which I don't. I'm glad he's finally gone. But he isn't gone because the shower head has become part of the sort of national lexicon. It's the when there were protests against Zuma, people came to the union buildings, the seat of government, with mining helmets with showers attached to them. The shower became a part of the protest. Everybody understood it was about Zuma and his crazy attitudes and it's satirizing him, lampooning him, making him look silly.
It's 2019. You've been cartooning since the 1980s. You take your role seriously as, you know, more than a court jester, but someone who's really going to call powerful people onto the carpet. Do you feel like that role of the satirist, do you feel like it's still alive and well in South Africa at this point?
I feel it's hugely alive and well. Even when one feels the cartoons are not always accomplishing what one wants them to accomplish, at least they're getting out. And South Africans really do talk to each other. I've been sued by Zuma before he was president, but right into his presidency. And I've come out of those things well. I've had death threats. I've been beaten up in public. I have faced a lot of consequences. I've also had the most incredible run of freedom of expression in this democracy where some of the electronic media have been very curtailed. But we've had a fantastic run in the print media. And our cartoons, mine and others, are able to really, really set the cat among the pigeons and get people talking and sometimes even have consequences. And I still feel there's a fantastic role here and elsewhere in Africa and all over the world for cartoonists.
South African political cartoonist Zapiro. Currently, he cartoons for South Africa's Daily Maverick. His book about Zuma is called WTF, Capturing Zuma, A Cartoonist's Tale. Zapiro, great to speak with you again. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
We stay in South Africa for a couple more minutes now, and we go on a journey as a young man and his mother travel to their native KwaZulu-Natal province to visit family. At least that's a story in the video to the tune Umama by South African singer Sjava. That's spelled S-J-A-V-A. Kendrick Lamar is a fan. Sjava has gotten his name and sound out there the past 2 years. He was featured on the Grammy-nominated soundtrack to Black Panther. He's been vocal about the need for better quality, more thoughtful music from young South Africans. He despises autotune or any glorification of violence or misogyny. Sjava's music leans on trap sounds from the American South and on South African styles like Maskandi and Mbakanga. The best part in the video to this number, Umama, is when Sjava and his mom are just hanging out, honoring their ancestors. We leave you today with chart-topping music from South Africa. The tune is Umama from Sjava. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.